and welcome to Future Library. It's a bright, fresh day. I'm saying that I'm a bit full of cold today, feel a bit bunged up. I may ask my lovely wife to go and get me something that I can actually blow my nose into in a short while. But the sun is shining. I did three podcasts yesterday and it was all dark and stuff outside. But it's nice today. Joined by Craig Weldon. How are you doing, Craig?
I'm good, thanks, Alex. Yourself?
I'm very good. Craig may be better known to some musicians as Craig Pulsar, the writer of the fantastic Tokyo Sex Whale and Dance Disco Robot, amongst many other hits. But he's an author and all sorts of things. A lot of people listening will know who you are, people who are familiar with you from the music scene in Scotland, but a lot of people won't know who you are. So tell us a bit about yourself, Craig.
Okay, well, I suppose if when it comes to artistic stuff, it's all kind of part-time, leisure hours sort of thing. One of the great things is I don't have a television, so that gives me lots of free time to do things. I've written a couple of books that have been published. I've written more, but they've not all been published, of course. And a couple of albums. Done various other things. Quite into hill walking as well. I've done lots of that. finished the Monroes. Do you know, I think one of your first guests was Gary Marshall.
Yes, very early on, yes.
And the first book I wrote was from way back in the mists of time. Gary used to run a message board called the Casino Message Board. Mm-hmm. And he put a message up saying this company that I'm working for are looking for somebody to write a book on guitar playing tips. I think it was guitar or big bass guitar. And I just put a message on saying, oh, what a shame they're not looking for keyboard tips, because that's my instrument. I play keyboards in whatever bands I've been in. And next thing I know, he messaged me back saying, yeah, they'd be interested in that. Give it a go. So I wrote off to them and that ended up being my first book. Was 101 keyboard tips, purely by, I suppose knowing Gary really, so that was pretty good.
It's helpful to know people like that, isn't it? It's helpful.
Yeah.
That's often the story of how people get in into these things.
So many thanks to Gary if he's listening.
Well, I think I remember the casino board fondly. I remember the casino board fallout as well. The Hector Collectors writing their song Banned from Casino.
That song.
Which had that amazing line, we used to be a band from casino, but now we're banned from casino.
Yeah.
And it's talking about...
Do you know...
What's that?
I once was threatened with a beating up around the casino message board. It says it's not a serious story, and maybe it's something to be cut out.
No, go on. You can tell this story.
There was a period where some people, the password was changed, and some people didn't know it, and some people did. And the people who didn't know it were going around the Glasgow underground music scene, badgering the people that did know it, and asking, if you know the password to the casino, like, tell me it. And for some reason, I was one of the ones that still knew the password. And Paul McGaz of My Legendary Girlfriend, who you've also had on the show, didn't know it. So he's like, what's the password? And I thought, well, I'm friends with Paul, but at the same time, I'm friends with Gary. So I was like, well, I don't know. I said, I can't really tell you. And he said, I'll set My Legendary Girlfriend on you. And I found it quite amusing. But, I think Enzo's actually quite handy, so maybe it would...
I was going to say, it's not much of a threat initially when you think about it. But yeah, Enzo's... I think he could probably handle himself. Enzo, their bass player, for any listeners who's unaware, I think he could be quite an imposing chap if he wanted to be.
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
I seem to remember the password, because the site is now gone long ago, so I think we can reveal this. Right. The password was, I think, I love clicks. Clicks.
Right, wow, I can't remember it at all. There's too many passwords now, there's too many.
See, I remember it because somebody told me it.
Uh-huh.
I can't tell you who it was, but somebody told me it. And then, because I had absolutely no scruples at the time, I just happily handed it out to everybody who was banned from casino. And there you go, Gary. There's an admission for you from 10 years ago. I handed it out to everybody who was banned from it, and Magaz and various people started. We kind of like observed it for several days. And I think what gave it away was. Go on.
It was highly amusing.
Yeah, and what gave it away was that Gary firstly noticed a load of hits from IP addresses that he previously didn't recognise. And also what gave it away was we started making snarky comments on public forums that kind of slightly referenced what was being said on there.
Right, yeah.
So it was pretty funny. Yeah, the drama back then.
I'm sure these things are still going on in other message boards and other universes all the time.
Well, I was going to say for younger listeners, message boards are what used to exist on the internet before Facebook.
Things existed before Facebook.
Yes, I know, Kat. Things did exist before Facebook.
I heard of this MySpace thing, but I sure, you know.
Yeah, and there was a thing called Friendster once.
No.
Yeah.
Oh, God. Now, how are you going back?
Archaeology of the internet will dig these things up at some point.
Yeah, yeah. It's all still there, yeah.
So what were the other...
It's a party website, of course.
So what were the other books you've then written?
Oh, well, I wrote a book about hill walking. My girlfriend at the time said, you should write a guidebook, because I used to go away every weekend. I was obsessed with it. And I sort of still am. Love it. Love getting out and about. And I started writing things down, but instead of being a guide, it was just sort of my experiences, really. It was anecdotes of things that we'd got up to. And so it took about a year to write, maybe a year to self-edit. It took about a year to find a publisher. And then once I got a publisher, it took another year before it actually came out. So that's quite a process, 4 years. And the unique selling point of the book, because I thought you have to have some sort of elevator pitch, unique selling point, was that there is a list of hills called the Marilyns. And I don't know if you've heard the Monroes.
Yeah.
Which is every hill over 3,000 foot. And this chap came along and he decided every hill over 150 metres, or rather with a drop all round of 150 metres. And he called them the Marilyns in a sort of... I think, you know, the Marilyn Monroe's kind of thing. And there's 1,551 of them across Britain.
Right.
So plenty, plenty hills. The nearest one to... You're in Birmingham at the moment.
Yes.
And the nearest one is, I think it's the Lickey Hills.
Yes, I'm aware of the Lickey Hills. They used to actually be quite near to where I used to live.
Right,
We used to live just outside Stourbridge. Now we live just outside Wolverhampton.
Right, oh yes.
Uh-huh. We're kind of making a tour of the Black Country as our places of residence. And wherever we go, people say yam instead of you are.
All right.
Yeah.
Well, I remember listening to Black Country Radio and there was a segment on local words. And this chap came on and he said, Gan Crassaleza, which sounds Australian there, sorry, but... nobody knew what it was, and apparently meant going across the field. Huh. Have you ever heard that?
I haven't heard that.
No.
To be fair, though, there's not many fields around here for people to say that out.
Yeah. You do have another good name.
When I first got here, I ended up in a situation where Alex was playing at the Katie Fitzgerald, and the first Black Country in I heard was... yam not local, but yam sorted. And we're like, what? Even Alex was like, I'm sorry, I didn't catch a word of that. And then they told him to play something with a bit of go. And oh, Danny boy. So he played something really fucking slow.
Yeah. I was like, do you have any crests? You could play something with a bit of go. This woman said. So I played something, I made up something really, really slow.
Right.
At that point. But yeah, I mean, yam not local, but yam sorted means you're not local, but you're all right.
Yeah. I'll pick that up. That sounds good.
But,
you know, a lot of people don't like the Birmingham accent, but kind of quite like it. It's a sort of, it lulls people into a false sense of security. People that aren't from the West Midlands sort of have this image in their head of Brummies, which is completely false.
Yeah, well, I think what's helping actually a little bit is people like Stuart Lee becoming successful, because Stuart Lee's got a Solihull accent.
Yeah.
you know, which is a slightly kind of posher Birmingham accent, but it is a Birmingham accent essentially. So it's a, you know, that kind of the greater conurbation accent. So I think that's helping, that, you know, that people are starting to hear the Birmingham accent in a non-comedy context. I'm not saying that Stuart Lee's not comedy, but they're hearing it in a context that it's not.
That's quite absurd. Comedy.
Yeah, they're not using it in a kind of like ha ha laugh at the accent kind of way.
Yeah, no.
You know, I think that's a, and I think actually, if anything, that Benefit Street is possibly helping with that as well, because people are seeing that that's actually how people talk. The interesting thing about the Birmingham accent is that. It's the same as when you're not living in Scotland, you just assume everybody in Scotland has the same accent. And when I moved to Scotland, after living in Scotland for a while, you know, and realising that the accents from town to town were very different, and even within cities you got different accents. It's the same in Birmingham, there's very different accents. Like the Dudley accent is different from the Stourbridge accent, which is different from the Wolverhampton accent, which is different from Birmingham City accent. You know, all the places have slightly different takes on the same accent, and you start to be able to identify where from Birmingham people are just based on their accents, which is interesting.
Have you achieved that ability yet, Kat?
Kat's actually just left the room, so I don't think she can answer. I think she's started to pick up those things.
Well, that's interesting. It's amazing the variety of accents across. The whole, you know, from Orkney down to Cornwall, the whole difference. Basically all just speaking the same language, but all different words and inflections.
And only having those accents because that's what they're hearing from people as they're growing up. And as they continue, because the funny thing is, if you move or you put yourself into a different situation, accents change pretty quickly. I mean, I found that when I moved up to Scotland, the first thing that changed, and the thing that's kind of stuck with me most, is the phrasing, I think, changes first before your actual accent starts to change. So I started finding myself saying out with instead of without, and, you know, things like that. And I think that's the hardest thing to lose once you've moved away. I think certain things. I think wherever you go, whatever accents you pick up over the years, you always pull a little bit with you.
Right.
So, I mean, I've lived in loads of different places, and, you know, I'm married to an American, and, you know, there's all these different things have kind of fed into my accent. So I don't even know what my accent is. I'd say fairly neutral kind of received pronunciation, which makes it sound poor.
You put on a coat almost of your local surroundings when you're in a place, and I don't think I picked up any Brummie when I was there, but I've picked up a bit of maybe from Aberdeen and from the west of Scotland. I live near Edinburgh now, so
yeah,
you know, just a generic sort of pretty boring Scottish accent. Do you remember?
Just to go back to your previous question, Kat has actually returned now. Craig was asking if you have reached a point yet where you can identify Birmingham accents within Birmingham and start to pinpoint where the people are from.
Not yet, because you have to keep in mind that my brain is still processing the broad differences between accents. Like, I can recognise the regional accents when they're broadly different. So,
like Liverpool, Manchester.
Newcastle. I can... Oddly enough, the accents that I can pick up the differentiation in the most are Scottish.
Yeah.
I can absolutely tell a Glaswegian from an Edinburghite, from a Dundonian, from even people who are a little bit, you can tell when their accents are off. For some reason, I picked up Scotland's accents much more than I recognise English accents.
Well, there's a distinct thing with Scottish accents, isn't there? I mean, there's Glasgow accents, very kind of sing-song. Edinburgh accent's a bit more kind of clear and well-spoken. The Dundee accent's kind of mumbly.
Well, the Dundee mumble, yeah.
Yeah, the Dundee mumble.
What was it that the sentence was, if you sound like a bear, you're probably from Glasgow? No. If you sound like a bear, you're from Dundee. If you sound like you could seduce a bear, you're from Edinburgh. Something like that.
I don't know that sentence at all.
There's this whole big thing that someone's talking about. But no, it's... For some reason, the Glaswegian accent delights me, because I have to talk to people day in and day out as part of my job, as part of my previous couple of jobs. And every time I get a Scot on the phone, if I realise they have a stupid grin on my face, I can guarantee they're from Glasgow. because there's something about the Glasgow accent that just delights me. I just like the sing-song quality of it. Alex, yeah. I could hear Alex talking about picking up bits. I've picked up phrasing quite a bit. One thing I have learned, however, is that your accent, especially if it's an American accent, doesn't change gradually. It doesn't sort of round off into a British accent. What happens is you get three or four words at first that you pronounce in a very weirdly British way. So it goes like American, 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 British, American, 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 British. No, the one that people laugh at me, and if I think about it, becomes really caricatured, is I have to think about saying it the American way. I can no longer say tomato because that feels really wrong in my mouth. So, so I'm like talking, I'm going to have a BLT with bacon, and then I'm like, yeah, and tomato, and people are like, tomato? It's like, no, shut up, quit mocking my tomato. But yeah, so tomato is one of those things that's become really posh. And apparently my phone voice is more British than my
speaking. Puts on a very posh...
I don't put it on, though. I don't even think about it.
She does.
Lots of people do. Lots of people do. It's like, hello?
Yes.
Hello?
My mum does. When she answers the phone to somebody, kind of, you know, when she answers the phone and it's not family, she's like, she talks in this very posh voice.
Do I?
No, you, my mum.
Oh, your mum.
Yeah, you do a little bit. You're like... I'm not going to do an impression because you'll punch me again.
It's better than the New York one, I'm sure.
There's quite a few American accents as well, but...
Oh, yeah.
Are they...
Alex seems to think there's only two.
Densely... Oh, no, there's loads.
No, Alex seems to think there's two. There's either the New York accent or there's the Deep South accent. That seems to be the two that people identify, and Alex tries to be a New Yorker, and it goes horribly
That's
awry.
That's the only two that I can impersonate perfectly without any flaw. What's that?
Can you do Woody Allen?
Well, he's a New Yorker, isn't he? So he'll twat right there. He's from New York.
Oh, God.
Because that's
really impressive.
Yes.
Yeah. No, see, the thing is, I have a friend who's from New Jersey. And I now have to say New Jersey because
Jersey.
Jersey is a completely different place in this country.
Jersey.
Stop it. But her name is Jenny Eva. And she was my friend Geneva's mother. And she had the best accent because she'd always go, why do people laugh at how I talk? What's so funny about how I talk? And we're just like, twalk. Oh, I love it.
Yeah, see, she's mocking me for putting a W into every word when I do my New York
accent. But that's actually how someone from Jersey speaks, whereas your New York accent sounds like the Bisquit ad.
Bisquit. Lovely Bisquit. God. Yeah. And then there's the Southern accent, isn't there? That's just like, uh-huh.
Excuse me, I was born in the South.
That's my favourite, yeah.
Just the sound, the single sound.
Oh yeah, just that sound of American, the Southern sort of accent. I remember seeing this chap on telly. He was a cowboy, and he'd been voted America's sexiest man. And this was one of these really intellectual shows, like Ricky Lake or. And this was a long time ago, and. She says, the interviewer says to him, so why do you think you've been voted America's sexiest man? And he's sort of sitting there with a twinkle in his eye and a sort of white teeth grin with his sort of cowboy boots up, and he tips his hat back and he says, well, ma'am, I don't rightly know. And the whole audience are like, oh.
See, the thing is, I was born in the Deep South, but the thing is, I argue, like Alex argues that he's Scottish by birth because he was born in Scotland.
Yeah.
But I was born in the Deep South, and I wouldn't ever say I'm Southern, because I'd lived there for a very short period of time in my infancy, and then moved. So I'm not really from anywhere, but I do the whole Mississippi thing, because I was born there. So I was born in Biloxi, Mississippi, M-I-S-S-I-S-S-I-P-P-I.
Sorry, we completely detracted.
The mint juleps.
I'm sorry, I didn't catch what you said.
I can taste the mint juleps.
So, sorry, that was a complete distraction from where you were going. Yeah. I do apologise.
Yeah, that's okay. Yes, elevator pitch. We were talking about this hillwalking book, aren't we?
Yes.
At some point. Yeah. the Marilyns and the Monroes. And you've got, there's a very nice Marilyn just west of Wolverhampton. Oh, well, west of Telford, really. The Wrekin, or the Wrekin.
Yes, I'm aware of that as well.
But, yeah, it's a nice hill. Really nice spot. Go up there for sunset and a summer's day. Beautiful.
There's some really nice ones. I mean, there's the Lickey Hills. There's the Clent Hills in just outside Birmingham as well. They were quite close to where we lived. Yeah, because the Lickies are down the Bromsgrove end, aren't they? So,
actually, no, you're right. It's the Clent Hills that's the nearest mile in that.
Ah, there you go. Yeah, and you can see Dudley Castle. Or it's not really Dudley Castle. It's not Dudley Castle. There's a kind of castle at the bottom of the Clent Hills, and you see it when you're at the top. You go, "What's that
it's a
castle?"
Folly.
And it's a folly.
Oh, right, yeah.
Yes.
That's a whole new concept to me as well. We don't do follies, we just do Renaissance fairs.
Yeah, Kat was completely unfamiliar with the whole idea of follies. So, yeah, so you've written this book, and you've written... I've got... Because you sent me a few messages before we started. You're working on another, I believe.
I've been working on it for a while. There was one thing I also wanted to say about that other book.
There's
551 Hills... And the list came out in about 1991, 92. So when I did mine, it was 14 years later, something like that. No, it was more than that. Anyway, it was 2009 it came out. And I wrote off to the chap. I thought, this is my unique selling point. This is the first time anyone's written a book about this list of hills. So surely it's going to be this massive big seller. It's, you know, it's unique. It's the first one. And I wrote off to the guy that wrote the original list of books. And I asked him how many he'd sold, because I thought, that would be my potential audience, readership. Mm-hmm. And he wrote back and said there was 3,000 printed. And remember, this was in 1992. And he still hadn't sold them all. And I thought, okay. I won't give up the day job yet. The new book, I've been collecting history. So it started off with Scottish history, because you don't... Yeah, it's hard to sort of learn. You don't really get it at school, or I didn't. Maybe kids nowadays do. And once you to sort of see where things all fit, you have to then start reading about British history. And then to see how things fit, you've got to read about European history. It all kind of spirals out of control in this sort of interconnected web of everything that's ever happened. So I'm just sort of thinking how I'm going to cut it down and maybe... bring something a bit more focused again. And especially this year, with there's an independence referendum later on in September, that could be a very good time to bring out a sort of new history book, potentially about Britain or Scotland. Although I'm guessing that every publisher and every historian worth their salt is probably thinking something along the same lines. So I don't know where my little book would end up in the sort of scrum of heavyweight historians. Oh, but maybe they're not doing that. Maybe they're just sort of waiting to see what happens, and you know, maybe not.
One of the things that people tend to forget. Suddenly get your weird echo.
Not at this end.
That was very odd. One of the things that people tend to forget about the way the monarchy and everything worked in Scotland and England was that the first joint monarch was actually a Scot, I believe. Of the United Kingdom.
That's right, yeah. And the predecessors, the Tudors, they had Welsh ancestry.
Yeah, so, you know, let's face it, the Welsh and the Scots actually won.
Well, you know, token victory, but yeah. Actually, maybe the Germans won, because they've been pretty much German ever since, when was it, 1714, George V?
Yeah, because didn't the Windsor family change their name from... Was it?
Yeah, Saxe-Coburg.
Yeah. Gotha. Was it the First World War they changed it during?
Yes, it was unfortunate because the Germans sent over these bombers called Gotha bombers to bomb, and they weren't very effective. You know, this is the First World War. Mm-hmm. I think it was mainly guys in flying goggles and sheepskin jackets dropping rude messages over the south coast of England. But it was a bit embarrassing for the royal family having the same name as these German bombers. So that's why they changed their name. It's interesting. And they were extremely German. I don't folk realise how German they were, because the first two were born in Germany, of the Georges. I think the third was born in England, but they all had German spouses. And that was the case right up until the late Queen Mother, who was from Glam's Castle, Scotland, actually.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, it's only in the last few generations there's been any kind of local input into the royal family, which is totally by the by, you know.
But at least they now speak English at Buckingham Palace.
Well, that helps, yes, definitely.
Rather than German kind of ringing around the halls, which I'm guessing probably happened. Yeah. So the history book, how far along with that are you?
I've probably collected all the material. I've got about 500,000 words, more than that, actually. So it's just a case of cutting it down. And the real key to things is, first of all, you've got to decide what your bias is going to be, because every history book is biased in some way or other. The only ones that aren't are utterly unreadable. Very academic tones can be quite interesting and very useful, but for a general reader, really off-putting.
Yeah, you almost have to apply your own narrative bias, don't you, so that you're telling the story that you want to tell with it.
Well, even if you're not putting a single judgmental word, if there's no adjectives in your entire book, just the choice of what you are including and what you're leaving out is a bias in itself. Mm-hmm. So that's the kind of... And I think if they make it clear up front, and as long as that's something you never see in a history book. You never will rarely see in the front of a history book, here are my prejudices, and be aware of that as you read this book. That in itself would be a good thing to have at the front of most history books.
I think it would. Are you going to put that at the beginning of yours?
Oh, maybe I should, yeah.
I should. I think that would be something. I've never come across that before. I think that would be... Because you're being completely transparent, aren't you? And the reader knows what to expect.
Yeah. So I'm saying this, but in the back of your mind, you should be thinking, is he telling the whole story? Is there maybe something else that's been missed out? I don't know.
Yeah, it saves the reader a whole lot of work. It saves history lecturers and teachers, you know, having to say, well, you need to work out what the bias of this writer was. You know, in yours, they could say, well, Craig's bias was this, because he lays it out in the foreword.
Yeah. You do have to be quite self-aware, though.
Yeah.
Maybe someone might read it and think the bias is completely opposite. You know?
Or maybe that they think that you've done it deliberately to throw attention away. It's like, he said that his bias is this, but actually he's pro-Nazi.
That's probably what they'll think. Yeah.
Just to clarify, Craig isn't pro-Nazi. Just in case anybody takes that out of context. Go on.
I once came across this... I was on holiday in Ireland, in County Kerry, and hostelling, going from hostel to hostel. I arrived in one hostel, and there was a intense young German fellow in one hostel, and he had a slightly odd position in the hostel. He didn't own it, and he didn't run it, but he was sort of living there as a odd job man, stroke handyman, stroke sort of living in grace and favour in this place, and he had his own room. And he really wanted to show me this computer language he'd written, which I was on holiday, I had no interest, but just to be polite, I went into his room, and he was yabbering away, sitting at the computer, but my eyes were just transfixed by his bookshelves, because every single book on his bookshelf was about the Nazis, Adolf Hitler, Second World War, Germany, and, he was a young German fellow, and it just seemed a bit odd. And I could understand if there's one or two books on that subject in a bookshelf with a wide variety of subjects, but this is the only subject on his bookshelf. I think he had a book on Java programming as well. There was that.
But it was Java programming for Nazis.
Yes.
It was the Third Reich big book of Java programming. Written in Gothic script on the front.
That could be. Well, there's a new series that maybe one of the big publishing companies
might have. Forward by Adolf Hitler. He goes, he's like, you know, I don't often program, but when I do, I use Java. He goes, when I was preparing the Second World War, I had to have some Java applets set up to manage my spreadsheets. Goes, this is the book I used. It's kind of interesting you mention that, because the last two books I've read, or one I've read and one I'm currently reading, are both have got the kind of whole Nazi thing going on. I read Making History by Stephen Fry, which was a real slog, and I'm reading The Teleportation Accident at the moment. I can't remember who wrote it, but that sort of that starts off in kind of the kind of Weimar Republic kind of era in Germany. Yeah. So I kind of think it's interesting. You've got this kind of little kind of weird, super kind of anything goes period between the two kind of slightly darker periods of German history. Mm-hmm. But you have this kind of little slice of kind of the artists and the decadent kind of took over for a bit.
Mm.
And then it all went to shit again and
definitely it was worse there than anywhere else, I think, wasn't it? Or it was like Zimbabwe with the currency going crazy.
Yeah.
Deutschmarks for a loaf of bread sort of thing.
Yeah, there's the famous photos, aren't there, of people with wheelbarrows full of money.
Yeah.
Wow. So the whole hyperinflation thing. So, yeah.
My mother used to collect stamps, and she would have a 250,000 mark stamp, and then inflation was so high that the post office would then, using one of those like stamping machines, they would put a even higher value over the top of it. So underneath, you can see it says 250,000 marks. And then over the top of that, they've gone and put 500,000 marks.
Wow.
It's extraordinary.
But it's a bit like what's happened in Zimbabwe, isn't it? That the money has become virtually worthless.
Yeah.
Because...
you can see why the Germans are careful about money now.
Yeah. Well, this is the thing. I mean, but it was effectively quantitative easing that was going on, you know. And if we've learned nothing from Zimbabwe and post-war Germany, we've learned that quantitative easing possibly isn't actually the best solution to a recession.
Well, yeah, it helps you pay off your debts because suddenly your debts are worthless. But so is your currency. Oh dear.
Yeah, it doesn't go well. Somehow we've managed not to fall into the trap of hyperinflation here. There's probably some guys behind the scenes in the Treasury working feverishly night and day to prevent it happening. But there you go. So when do you think the history book will be out?
Well, like I say, the end of the year would be a good target, but it's just a matter of finding the time for it. I used to work shifts, which was great for really... during the day, getting work done on things.
Mm-hmm.
It's a bit harder now. You know, I live out of town and commute. But maybe I could incorporate some work into commuting time. I don't know.
Yeah. If you have a portable computing device, you could.
Mm-hmm. I do cycle, so it could be challenging.
you can't really sit there working on your laptop as you cycle to work.
Work something out there.
Oh, but what you could do is you could use the mic on your phone and dictate into it.
Right. Uh-huh.
But then you probably would get a load of absolute gibberish.
It would mainly be wind noise, I expect.
Yeah. And lots of stuff about somebody called Wayne or something. And you'd be like, why is all this mention of Wayne? I didn't say the word Wayne at all at any point. And it will have just picked every other word as Wayne. It just seems to be what happens. You say things into the kind of speech recognition on an iPhone, and it picks up people's names rather than what you've actually said.
Oh, okay. I've not tried that. Not tried the voice recognition stuff. Although I do like the accessibility voice that will read things out to you. That's great, especially if you choose English as the language and then get it to read a foreign language. Hilarious.
Well, is that the man who talks a bit like this?
Yes.
See, that, we like him because we use the sat nav on our phone, on my iPhone, and around near us there's a road called Dudley Southern Bypass, and whenever we get to that, he says it like Brian Butterfield, the Peter Serafinowicz character. He goes, "Turn left on Dudley Southern Bypass." It's like every time we're like, "Ha ha, Dudley Southern Bypass." It does have some problems. It calls. It says whenever we can sell it to take us home, he goes, "Getting directions to Alexander Button home." I'm Alexander, apparently.
Yeah, baffling.
But yeah, I mean, we're mocking it, but it's actually rather amazing that it can understand spoken commands.
I suppose, yeah.
Like if I say to it, "Call my wife," it will ring cat.
Mm-hmm.
So that's pretty good. But the other thing I wanted to quickly ask you about, you're writing a musical?
Yeah, it's going to be awesome. In November, I did a play. It was Julius Caesar, Shakespeare's Julius Caesar, with music. And it was great. And I thought, you know what? I wrote quite a lot of songs for it, and a lot of them weren't really considered the appropriate sort of vibe.
Were they like disco numbers about Julius Caesar?
I had one called Julius Caesar Must Die.
Yeah, and
the things we do for Rome, and they're all kind of like numbers. And I thought, you know what? If that's what I'm writing, then I'll just go the whole hog and write a musical. I think that would be great.
I have to ask: was there any point where Caesar had to grab somebody, and you could use the line "Seize her, Caesar"?
There was one point when yes.
And did you use the line "Caesar, Caesar"?
No. It's a missed opportunity. It's disappointing.
He sees her, Caesar. There's another one. There you go.
Yeah, she's over there. Mm-hmm.
He's having a seizure, Caesar.
Yeah, absolutely. It rewrites itself.
It does, doesn't it?
There's a whole song for you.
Already.
Yeah, you've got to do it. You've got to write a Caesar character into your musical. So what is the musical about?
Well, it's about the suffrage movement and how where women got the vote, and especially the relationship between... Right, I'm going to say this wrong. I have a bad habit of... Is it Emmeline or Emmeline Pankhurst?
I always thought it was Emily Pankhurst.
Is it Emily?
I always thought it was Emily. Let me have a look.
Well, so I'm just making... This woman's a figment of my imagination, then. Who's Emmeline Pankhurst? And Keir Hardie. That was quite an interesting relationship they had, because Keir Hardie was a socialist and one of the first Labour MPs, and he was a almost saint-like character. When you read a biography of him, he just was, you're like, how can one guy be so caring and concerned and nice about stuff? And all his, he was so right on, and not in a hey guys, you know, I really care about wild animals sort of way, but in a much more really deep way. And he got involved with the suffragettes, Emmeline.
Well, it's actually, it looks like it's Emmeline, but it Emmeline. Was known as Emily. But yeah, Emmeline right. is actually the full name. So I just looked it up on the internet.
Okay. So they became friends because he was, if you can think of a progressive cause, then Keir Hardie was pretty much in favour of it. So women getting the vote, obviously, right. He was an ally of the suffragettes. And Emily was very happy to have this support. But when the First World War broke out, the Great War, she took a decision that the suffragettes would stop, they would cease their activities, and they would support the war effort wholeheartedly, which was actually worked out well for the suffragettes, because straight after the war, women got the vote. It was sort of recognised that this had happened. There'd been solidarity with the sort of war effort. But Keir Hardie was heartbroken because he didn't support the war, and because people going off and shooting each other for no real reason was a complete anathema to him. And he sort of pined away in jail because he was a pacifist. And he had the sort of fair point that if people refused to fight, there would be no war. But, you know, that Emily was a lot more hard-headed, the right word for it?
Pragmatic?
Pragmatic. So Keir supported her cause, but when it came to the crunch, she wouldn't support his. Some of the suffragettes did, and some of them became pacifists, and they broke away, and they fell out with Emily Pankhurst. And in her later years, she actually became quite reactionary, sort of a big fan of the Empire and everything, which is, you know, takes all sorts. But, you know, she won one woman the vote. But I think the relationship between those two folk is very interesting, very, very fascinating. And there's suffragette hymns that have already been written, so that's a few songs already there. So it's just a case of getting the script. That's the most important thing. Then getting the songs, and then finding a venue. And there's some great venues around, but kind of hard to get your hands on some of them. And the cast, yeah, we need a cast, yeah. Okay. So it's a big thing. It's probably years in the making, I think.
I was going to say, one of the things that's happening, I'm seeing that's happening from kind of the perspective of distance, is that whereas English licensing law has changed so that if you've got a venue that holds fewer than 200 people, you don't need a music license.
Right.
It seems that Scotland, that maybe didn't have any licensing at all for that kind of thing, is now starting to, by on a kind of city-by-city basis, is kind of imposing very odd licensing on things. It seems almost that it's going the opposite direction, because previously in Scotland you could have, you know, a show in a house and you wouldn't get arrested by the police for doing it and told to shut it down unless there were noise complaints. It seems now that, from what I'm reading, like, you know, that Glasgow Council are kind of cracking down on things and other councils are starting to be a little bit more kind of draconian almost. It's very odd, because Scotland has always been traditionally quite open for you to be able to just play music wherever you wanted and things. So I don't know what's happening there.
I don't know. If you go back far enough, Scotland was quite a benighted country for entertainments. You know, no, bars weren't open on Sundays, and you were basically kicked out of pubs during a period in the afternoon.
Mm-hmm.
And then it changed, and licensing laws became better than they were. Well, certainly looser than they were in England for a while. And that was the case up until just quite recently. But recently in England, there's been 24-hour drinking laws.
Yeah, nobody really does it, to be honest, though.
And there's also, like you say, like these new sort of rules coming in about stuff. And also another thing in Scotland they're doing is trying to make booze more expensive and harder to get. So, you know, supermarket deals you can't get in Scotland anymore. It's an attempt to reduce the alcohol, bad health stats, I think.
Mm-hmm.
But it does sort of, they sort of try and improve the health, but at the same time takes away a bit of the gaiety, perhaps.
Yeah, it's sort of, you know, you're taking away the fun of the drunks on the street.
Yeah, it's just get to work. Yeah.
Well, the whole thing was, what was it as well, that when the government started bringing in things of saying that you couldn't do two-for-one deals and stuff, didn't the alcohol companies just respond by cutting the price of the individual items so that it was still pretty much exactly the same anyway?
What tends to happen now is you just don't see them. I don't think the companies cut the price. Maybe they do. I'm not really that aware of it, because I don't really buy multi-packs of booze, so it's never really affected me anyway. Like, you, like, I go in, I'm like, what craft ale will I get? I'll stroke my beard and, you know, think, oh, yeah, you know, that sort of frumpy ferret, that sounds good. Yeah, I'll get that for my, have my meal tonight. Maybe I'll pour it out in a wine glass, you know. So I'm getting old, that's all it is.
So you're not the kind of person that goes in and goes, how many bottles of Buckfast can I get for this pile of change and some string in my pocket?
Not anymore.
Not anymore.
No. Maybe in the past.
You've gone past that.
Yeah.
Well, I'm aware that we're coming to the end of the hour that we had set aside. Is there anything that we've not covered that you would like to mention that you're doing?
Well, what I'm doing, not really, I suppose. Do you know what, though? I was thinking about something recently. And it's related to how people work and all the things that we get up to.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a sort of an apocryphal story of Russians and the space program. And NASA, in this story, developed at a huge cost an underwater pen that could write upside down and in zero gravity. I don't think they did. I think that was just a marketing spiel by the pen company. And the sort of the kicker, the kind of the payoff in this story is that the Russians used pencils in their rocket, and, you know, just a sort of a way of working smarter rather than throwing lots of technology at it. And there was a real an example of that in the fighter program back in the 80s and 90s. And the US, and I think most Western countries actually, spent a lot of money on G-suits and counteracting the forces of gravity when people are pulling really tight turns in fighter planes. Mm-hmm. So that was a really big thing. And the Soviet military, the second day of training for fighter pilots, was they stuck them in this gigantic centrifuge and spun them around. And the ones that couldn't hack it just were kicked off the course. And they just weeded out lots of people that way. But it's a more sort of, it's a low-tech way of doing it. And yet it's kind of, it's a clever way of doing it at the same time. And I think there's a lot of folk nowadays are maybe not working in that smart way. They're sort of maybe going, oh, we'll get this tech in and it will help. But actually, it's just a process change that needs to change rather than anything else.
Well, you see, the thing is, in our house, Kat and I are very fond of kind of using technology to do things,
yeah,
but
yeah.
We tend to try and then find the simplest solution with that thing. You know, I'm a fan of making things as easy as possible, so I fully appreciate the kind of not overcomplicating things. Then going back to your story about the pencils thing, the funny thing about that story is that the actual truth of it is that if you use pencils in a rocket or a space station or something like that, you've got the risk of little bits of carbon getting into the circuitry and actually wrecking the thing. So the Russians didn't actually use pencils at all. They used the same pens as the Americans did.
Okay, I knew it wasn't a true story.
Yeah, that's the thing that I always thought was kind of interesting about that one, because it's told as if, look at these silly Americans. Look at the Russians wisely using pencils. And then I think it's some kind of propaganda story. It's an amusing one. It's one that gets passed around. It's like all these stories that get passed around and, you know, a lot of people don't check them. They just kind of go, you know.
It confirms prejudice, and therefore people don't want to check it.
Yeah.
That's like, right, oh, that sounds good. It's like the story of the American battleship telling somebody to get out of the way, and the radio reply comes back, no, you should move out of the way. And the American battleship, you get out of the way. And the reply comes back, we're a lighthouse.
Yeah.
And I'm sure that's not true. You get these emails from people that you don't know very well. And when you read the list that's been forwarded on several times, and right at the bottom there's some sort of flashing animations and one of these stories just like that.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it just sounds so good because it talks about, you know, the pomposity of the West and then going, well...
I've heard that the battleship and lighthouse story, I've heard that told so many different times with different nationalities.
And I've heard different ones about various things on airplanes, but it's always a different sort of flight, like the famous one about... some woman is sitting next to sat next to a black lady and starts raging about how dare she has to sit next to this scum, you know. And they're like, well, I certainly understand, ma'am, that you wouldn't want to sit next to, you know, someone you found distasteful. So we'll be moving the black lady to first class.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, there's all these kind of urban myths. You know, the thing with the battleships, surely the battleship would have charts to show where lighthouses were. And sat nav.
They do get some sort of rudimentary training on these sort of things.
They don't go just for, you know, the first day isn't, you know, this is the anchor. The second day, this is the go switch. Now you're an admiral. Yeah. It's not quite like that, is it? I think there's at least a third day of training that says, and this is where lighthouses are.
This is the gun, don't point it at yourself, something like that.
Mind you, I do have a theory that with Ryanair, whenever we've flown with them, we've never had a good landing with Ryanair. And I do have a theory that in the week training that their pilots get, that the first 6 days of the training are how to take off. And then the last day is, you know, you dress down, obviously, the last day, because it's the last day of training. And they tell them that landing is just taking off in reverse and not to worry about it.
It is a bit.
I don't think Ryanair train pilots. I think that's one of their cost-cutting measures. They only take on pilots that are already trained.
Via the Russian method. They chuck them in a cockpit, and if they don't crash the plane, they stay on the They finish the stay.
If they don't crash the first six planes.
Yeah, they put them on the second day of training. They took them in a plane.
And they fly to Germany.
If you come away alive, then you're hired.
Yes. Yeah, if you cause a catastrophe that you then have to sweep under the carpet, then I mean I'm not saying that Ryanair do that because obviously that might be illegal for me to say
that
such
might
a thing.
Be slightly slanderous.
Yeah, but you know. So Craig, it's been an absolute pleasure speaking to you. Where would people go if they want to find out more information about you?
That's a good point. If they want to see about my music, of which I've not done that much recently, the last thing was a little song that start of last year even. That would be pulsarbeat.co.uk. But if they wanted to see other stuff, maybe my travels around or stuff about my book, that would probably be best at theloveofscotland.com, which I'm planning to update soon with a little map and stuff like that. So you can click in it and read little stories about different places.
Fantastic. I will put links to both of those in the information about the podcast.
Okay. Thanks
very much. So I guess all that's left to say is a future library. Goodbye. Goodbye.
Bye.
Thank you for downloading this episode of Future Library. Future Library is brought to you by PetPiranha.com and is hosted by myself, Alex Bottom. The podcast is free, but if you do want to show your appreciation, feel free to go along to alexbottom.co.uk and click through to music, where you'll be able to find things that you can buy, or go to asmallglassghost.co.uk where you can buy my latest music. Episodes come out when I feel like it, mostly weekly. But that's it, so thank you for listening.